Hello, I'm Renee Vaughan Sutherland, and welcome to Greater Than 11%, a weekly podcast that explores roles and opportunities within the creative industries, with the aim of contributing to increasing diversity across the board, in addition to promoting some awesome women. Episode 52, our final episode in Series 1, we are joined by composer Hannah Kendall. Growing up in a house filled with music, her grandfather played the saxophone, her mother played the piano, she was signed up to play the violin at age 4. She developed an absolute love of music and also began playing the piano at age 7, going to her local library in northwest London to borrow CDs of Baroque music for inspiration. In her teen years, still focused on classical music, she was performing in youth orchestras, but developed an interest in UK garage and North London grime, going out dancing to music that was mostly aired on pirate radio. Finishing school, she went to Exeter University to study music, focusing on singing. Due to an admin error within the university in her second year, she had to take an additional class to make up her credits. She opted for writing and composing, as it was something she enjoyed when she did the compulsory module in her first year. Witnessing her exceptional talent and skill, her tutors encouraged her to apply to the Royal College of Music for a Master's in Advanced Composition, which she still credits the experience as being influential to her work up until today. On graduating, she worked on projects developing her writing career, while simultaneously working in arts management and teaching composition at the Junior Royal Academy of Music. But she came to a point where she felt she needed to focus on her practice and was successful in securing a fellowship as part of the Doctoral Music Arts Program at Columbia University, New York. With strong connections to her Guyanese heritage, she focuses on weaving stories of history, perceptions, and experiences into her music, such as one of her recent pieces, Disillusioned Dreamer, which premiered at the Berkeley Symphony in California in February this year. She mined the work from Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, zooming in on types of black men clinging to the belief that they can succeed in segregated America. And then Vidala, which premiered at the BBC Proms in 2018 at the Royal Albert Hall. Vidala refers to the ship that transported West Indian soldiers from the Caribbean to Europe during World War I. And then there's Knife of Dawn, which opened at the Roundhouse London in 2016, a one-man opera following the story of Guyanese poet and activist Martin Carter and his imprisonment told through a libretto based on his poems. Hannah has featured on BBC Radio 3's Composer of the Week, and she has also won the Futures Award for Arts and Culture, which celebrates remarkable female talent. Hannah is now based in the US, and it's taken quite a few months to try and land a time where we can both meet up to discuss her incredible talents, music, and career. Hannah, I cannot deny that I'm totally giddy to finally welcome you to Greater Than 11%.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So I'm wondering if we can start, if you can give us a bit of an overview of what it is a composer does.
Well, I suppose it's individual for each composer. I mean, obviously, we write music, and I specifically write contemporary classical music. And my day from one day to the next can be completely different. But I've nailed down my optimum working time, which I think is the most important thing any composer or any creative can do, is to figure out what time of day when you're most creative. And for me, it's certainly the nighttime. And so I try and gear my day up to writing at my most productive time, which is after lunch, really. And so I try and do all of my administrative tasks early in the morning when I don't have to really use my brain as much as I would have to when I'm trying to write on whatever compositional project I'm working on.
Okay. I touched upon it a little bit in the intro, but can you give us a bit of an overview of your kind of career history up until now?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, I find it really interesting that, and I suppose it is interesting, that the point which is often picked up on is the fact that I fell into composing by mistake. I had always been musical, and as you said, you said that I started music from a very early age, but that was because my mother signed me up to violin lessons when I was 4 without me even knowing about it. I just turned up to school one day and there were hundreds of tiny violins, and I was part of the new violin group at school and never really looked back. And so whilst I always enjoyed performing as a young girl with my peers and singing and playing the recorder and, you know, all of those usual introductory routes into music making, I fell into composing mostly because I hadn't really considered that it would be a career option for me. I'd never seen, certainly a woman of colour who was a composer, or I don't think I'd played music by a woman until I had got to university. And Exeter was such an incredible environment that not only championed new music in general, not only learning about it, but performing it, but really encouraging all of the students there to write music. And, you know, as you said, it was compulsory in the first year to do so. And so when, you know, they changed the credits at university, I had to make up the right number of credits to graduate. And so I took the composition class because Joe Dedell, who was the composition teacher at Exeter, was such an encouraging teacher, and just because he encouraged everyone to write music. And that's something that I really connected with. And so that was an easy decision to take that class. But I just found that I loved it so much, and I could already tell that if I'd just put in the extra work that I needed to, that I'd probably be better at that than at anything else I was doing at university. So that was really cool, and I haven't really looked back since. And I've just always been really focused on having very specific goals and knowing, you know, the sort of things I wanted to write, and to just keep trying to make those opportunities happen so that I could keep progressing and just, you know, taking one step at a time. And so, and that's where I am today.
It kind of struck me when you said, and I hadn't really thought about that, but that notion that music that you were taught at school, so primary and secondary school, was always written by men.
Yeah.
Actually, that's unbelievable, isn't it? Like, that completely sets or sends a message, unintentionally,
yeah,
for sure. But yeah,
absolutely.
And do you know if that's changed?
There's an incredible, I can't remember her name, but there's an incredible young girl who was studying A-levels a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And she was saying that all of the composers on the music syllabus for A-level are men and not alive. They're mm-hmm. dead men. Mm-hmm. And, you know, something needs to change. Mm-hmm. And I think the initial response is that, well, you know, whilst we'd love to have some women included in the syllabus, there haven't really been that many women who have contributed in a significant way throughout history. Mm-hmm. And obviously she challenged this. And so this young girl campaigned against the examination boards to include women. And so really it's been very recent yeah. that women have even been included in music syllabuses at A level.
Yeah.
And so I think things have certainly changed since I was a young girl.
Yeah.
You know, as you said, I would spend my Saturdays after my piano classes going to Willesden Green Library and checking out Bach CDs because I was really cool. But I don't think it's an exaggeration to say I had literally not performed any music by women until mm-hmm. I went to Exeter University, and I was brought into the world of Elizabeth McConkie and Nicola Lefanu and just all of these incredible women composers who, you know, just aren't part of the core of learning classical music in this country.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, obviously you're going to be on the syllabus soon, so that's awesome.
Well, I don't know about that, but I hope so. But I think, you know, I think we can do better in yeah. the syllabus, because I think even now it's only, you know, two or three women. And I think we have to keep championing and to keep campaigning, because to ensure that the change evolves with the evolving environment that we're working in.
Yeah, I'm growing the next generation fairly yeah. early on. It's like you're saying, it's having the possibility that it's an option, like something that you can aspire to.
Absolutely. And the fact that the women are there, and the women from minority backgrounds are there as well. Mm. And we just have to just scratch below the surface and just find all of this incredible music that, for reasons we probably know, have been just written out of the canon and out of history.
So another thing struck me when you were talking about kind of your love of music and being really cool and going to the library on a Saturday is that, like, I'm really not musical. I love music, but I have not got any sense of how to read music or even hear it properly, I think. So I always feel like it's a language I'm kind of excluded from. And when you're talking about writing music, like, can you talk a little bit about that process? What would be the stepping off point at a new project?
You know, it's quite an overwhelming thing, you know, especially if you're, you know, writing a large-scale piece for orchestra where there are, you know, literally hundreds like, well, between 80 and 100 people, and they all need notes to play. Although sometimes, if I'm honest, I forget that. If there are triple winds, which means if there are three flutes, for example. Yeah. And it actually happened to me recently where I was writing for a tripled wind orchestra, which means three of every woodwind instrument, mm-hmm. and getting to the end, and it's like, oh no, the third oboe only has five notes or something. And, you know, because and even if you've been doing it for years and years and years, with, you know, large scale stuff, it can be overwhelming. And so I found my own way of making it easier just for me to get that ball rolling, because starting a piece is so difficult, is to create a graphic score, which means it's literally using shapes and graphics and just sort of diagrams to just plot how I want the piece to sound. And, you know, it might not mean anything to anyone else, but for me it's just about saying, you know, I might want the whole orchestra to be playing together and sounding really full and really bold, but then a minute later it just, you know, might come down to just a single instrument. And it's just about plotting how the piece might sound, and without having to think about the harmony or the specific notes, just having an idea. And then actually, to be honest, more often than not, it completely changes and you're like, oh, this piece hasn't, you know, turned out at all how the graphic score is. But it's just by having that, it just sort of gives me a map to just getting the ball rolling. Otherwise, you might not know how to start at all.
I love this. I found a video where you were talking about this, and they showed some of the layouts that you did.
Oh, cool, yeah.
And that, to me, was my into the language, because I'm a visual person. So I was like, oh! Suddenly I was like, oh, I see, and I made that connection, which was so lovely. Is that typical process of someone who composes music, or is that just you've discovered that along the way?
I think it works for me. I know some people who have synesthesia, and so, which means that they hear colour. Mm-hmm. And so using colour and drawings helps them to get the ball rolling on starting their compositions. And obviously there are some composers who just work with graphic score. Mm-hmm. So they create graphic scores and then the musicians react to the graphics that they're seeing. Oh, wow. And they can, you know, improvise within a certain structure that the composer has set. And that's really interesting. But for me, I use it as a tool to start composing, because, you know, even though I do have the language, there are so many layers going on. And it's literally language that I've been, you know, in quote, speaking since the age of four. Mm-hmm. And it's still incredibly overwhelming, because there's, you know, there's harmony and instrumentation and orchestration, and it's just so many things going on in the mix. And so I find it easier to just have that visual reference while starting.
Yeah, that's amazing. I definitely would love to see more of that, because, like I said, I really felt like that moment, like, oh, I've got a little hook in.
So, that's cool. Yeah. I'm quite embarrassed by them, because obviously they're nothing. Yeah, because it's not like great works of art or something.
But that's not what you're doing it for.
No, I know. But I suppose that I'm aiming for that, for the finished product. And so it is a bit, because I forget that people do find them quite interesting, and they might like to see them. And then it's just embarrassing showing them my very limited, you know, as in like visually limited way of getting the process going.
Well, I disagree. They were like eye-opening for me. I really, really enjoyed them.
But I love that. I think that's really great. And it is, because I think, you know, music and the creation of music and explaining how one constructs new compositions is multifaceted and very multi-layered. And so actually, I think it's great to hear that that's a way in. Yeah. That's really cool.
Cool. So I wonder if we could talk a little bit more about your work. I mentioned a few. But I'm wondering if you talk about how you take a starting point, or you take a stepping off point from something that you've either read or seen or know. And the example I'm thinking of is the political activist Martin Carter, where you compose Knife of Dawn. So can you talk about how that works, that you find something and then you start on that journey of telling a story?
Hmm. Yeah, for me, that's usually the start of the process. often inspired by texts and literature and stories. You know, and even if, you know, the music itself, you know, even if it doesn't become programmatic. So, for example, if a piece is inspired by a piece of artwork, it's not necessarily a very specific musical representation of that artwork. It can be relatively abstract. It's a roundabout way of saying that my music isn't necessarily narrative, but more often than not, it does take its inspiration from literature or texts. And so Martin Carter, he was a political activist and he was an incredible man of Guyanese heritage, which is where my mother's family is from. But also he was an incredible poet who was a political activist in his own right, yes, but also through his poetry, which is the most incredible thing for me. The Knife of Dawn came about by drawing together his poetry and creating a story that told his own life story, where he was imprisoned without charge whilst fighting for Guyana to be independent from the British Empire. And he went on a hunger strike, and that's where that chamber opera was set. And I'm incredibly fond of that piece because it just drew together so many of my interests of social justice and poetry and my African Caribbean heritage and, you know, all of these things. And also trying to bring contemporary opera to broader audiences as well. And because of Martin and his story, which has relevancy to so many different people in the United Kingdom, I just loved how that just spoke to people who wouldn't ordinarily go to contemporary classical opera. And it's probably the most difficult project I've ever worked on. I produced it myself because I was just, if I'm honest, I was getting frustrated that there weren't many operas that would specifically include a person of colour. And there's, you know, so much talk, especially in the UK, about diversity and inclusion in classical music and opera. And I just wanted to create a role that was specifically for someone of African Caribbean heritage so that there could never be a discussion about who would ever sing that role. Mm-hmm. It was such an incredible thing, but it was so difficult. I got shingles, it was so stressful, so I'm literally scarred from the experience. But it was such an important creative turning point for me, and it just sort of crystallized what it is that I want to do as a music creator and as an artist. And so whilst it was incredibly difficult, I'm really fond of the project and really proud of it as well. Yeah, all of that inspiration from Carter and his own story of resistance and resilience, which I think is really cool, and just beautiful poetry as well.
What were the difficulties of getting it off the ground then that led you to being like, fuck it, I'm going to do it myself and get it out there, which is so difficult. I know that from my own experience, like producing my own film, but trying to produce it and be in that moment and be creative, and your energies are divided, and so I'm not surprised. And putting it on at the Roundhouse, it's not a small venue.
Yeah, to be honest, that was the most easiest thing, actually. I love telling this story because it's just a great testament to the Roundhouse, because as part of this whole thing, I wanted this piece to not necessarily be at a venue associated or traditionally associated with classical music. And I just thought, what is the venue that I love, like I just love the most? And, you know, I just sort of grew up going to the Roundhouse and going to pop concerts, and I, you know, just really love the vibe there. And so when I was thinking, I was just like, oh my goodness, what, you know, what if I asked the Roundhouse if I could have this, if I could have this opera there? And I had this 10-point list of bullet points, and I remember going to the meeting and you know, getting in the zone for convincing them to have a contemporary opera there. And I just sat down and had a great meeting with Rachel Nelkin, who was there at the time, and was just like, oh, you know, can I have my opera here, please? And she's just like, yeah, sure, sounds great. And
I was like, point one.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I was like, okay, cool. Yeah, but as you say, it was just wearing all of these different hats. And because, you know, for 13 years, whilst I was writing, I was also working in the industry. And so you know, I had the skills to be able to produce the thing and, you know, raise all of the money and get the musicians on board and find the venue and blah, blah, blah. But looking back, I don't think that is something I really should have had to have done, actually. Mm. And that was the stress of it and juggling it all. I mean, writing a piece of music theatre in itself is enough. And I think, thank goodness, I was relatively naive where I thought, oh, yeah, you know, it's just a one-man opera. And it's 60 minutes and, you know, oh, yeah, that'd be fine. But actually, 60 minutes of contemporary classical music that has to be dramatic is, oh, my goodness, it's such an undertaking. And I'm about to embark on a second opera project. And even just thinking about writing the music material itself is overwhelming as it is. I have no idea how I did all of that other stuff on top of it. But actually, so, but for the second project, I'm working with the same librettist and director. And so we had a meeting on Sunday and we were saying that, or I was saying that what's really interesting is that because things are changing, that 3 years ago, The Knife of Dawn, you know, probably would have been difficult for it to have been commissioned or produced by somewhere else. But I don't think it would necessarily be the same now, which is really cool. I think I could go to a producing house and really pitch the idea, and it probably would have a good shot of being commissioned, which is encouraging. But, you know, I still say if I hadn't have done that myself, I'm not entirely sure that the opportunities that I've had since then would have come my way. So, it's a big pat on the back to us.
And taking a risk, isn't it? It's like pushing yourself. Like, obviously, your talents go without saying, but knowing you can do it, but going, I need to do it, because if I don't, it's not going to break through to the next bit of where I need to be on the next point.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there can be more of that certainly in classical music, because, and especially being in the States at the moment, which is incredible and has so many great opportunities for the arts and creativity in itself. But because we have such a great supportive network of classical music in this country, which I've really realised since going to the States, is then we have the BBC, we have all of these incredible orchestras where, you know, if that's what you want to do as a composer, there are so many opportunities for you to work and sort of test ideas out in orchestras before the big commissions come, because as I said before, it's a lot of so many musicians, and, you know, and there are so many things that could go wrong, but we have all these incredible training opportunities. And because we have that, I think classical musicians could be better at just taking the bull by the horns. And if you've got a really crazy idea, to just somehow do it yourself and go for it. And, you know, I would encourage classical musicians to apply for things, apply for money, and just get things done and get really exciting things going.
Get moving.
Yeah.
So, can I ask you about how you shape a story? So you've been inspired by something, whether it's like Martin's poetry or narratives that you're learning about, or you've got an idea. How do you then start? Because like you said, you're not necessarily working in a pure narrative sense, and telling story with music obviously is through another language. So how do you shape that?
I suppose it is primarily through the harmonic structure, actually. Mm-hmm. And so, because, which, yes, it's a difficult question to answer, because whilst it's storytelling in an abstract way, it isn't necessarily a narrative story, structured. Even though there's, and so this is the first time I thought about it, and because I've ever been asked that question before, and I think it has a lot to do with the harmony and where the ear is taking you, or where the music is taking your ear. And so that's why actually plotting the harmony, so once I've done the graphic score, I actually then plot the harmonic structure, so like the chords of how I think the music will sound that will best represent what's happening graphically. And so if I take that example from before of having like the whole orchestra playing and it's bold and it's you know, a big sound and cacophonous, I will find the right notes to then match that sound and go along throughout the graphic score to plot that. And so I think in my music, that's probably the way that the story is shaped mm-hmm. in an abstract way rather than, you know, actually telling a narrative tale.
Just watching you describe that and talk about it, I kind of just had this vision of then you being in with all these musicians and then them playing the kind of graphic score through to writing and the shaping of it. What is that feeling like when you, like, for the first time, you know, obviously it's not perfect and they're all kind of trying it out, but then hearing it with you know,
yeah,
other people?
It's probably... I'm sorry to burst a bubble. It's probably less exciting than I think you're suggesting, because I think you get to, I mean, obviously it is exciting to finally be working with real living musicians, having been on your own for however many weeks or months. But I think you get to a certain point where, and especially when you're working with orchestra, because rehearsal time is relatively limited and part of the training is to get to a point where you shouldn't be surprised by anything that's happening. Mm-hmm. And so when they play, and I have to say that certainly in this country, they are, these musicians are so great and they can pretty much pick it up and play it and it sounds amazing. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, things just get even better as they refine what it is that you've given to them. But really, it is... Yeah, like one shouldn't be surprised by what is coming back at
you. So I'm just romantically looking in at this note.
Yeah, I'm really sorry. I didn't know whether to go along with that.
No, but
I actually, it's like, oh yes, it sounds how I thought it would sound, which is good, which is great. And it's more about being able, because, you know, obviously we're all human and things are never perfect. And if things aren't working, it's about thinking very quickly on your feet and knowing how to remedy things which might not be working. And if you're working with a great conductor, if you're working with an orchestra, for example, it's just, that's just the dream, because then, you know, you can work together to really just really refine what it is that you wanted to happen, and the magic happens, which is cool.
Which is a great segue, because I am so fascinated by the relationship between a composer and a conductor, because it's like handing over a child or a baby that you've shaped and putting it out in the world. So how does that work from a complete outsider? Like, how does that relationship, how does the discussion, how does the passing over of it work?
Well, I think part of becoming comfortable with being a composer is being able to hand it over and knowing and trusting the people who you've given your piece, your baby, over to, and being comfortable with the fact that different people will perform it in different ways. And that's actually being the beauty of it. That's about the beauty of the live experience, rather than, you know, having something recorded and listening to the same recording over and over again. And that's the beauty, is that it's a real, you know, living, breathing thing that is modified depending on how people are feeling from one note to the next, and how people come together. And so it became a much more enjoyable experience for me once a penny dropped. So that's something I do have to say. The relationship between composer and conductor is so important, and it's just so great when you get to work with someone that you just have a really good working relationship with and you trust. And actually, I've just been working with Jonathan Hayward in Seattle, with Seattle Symphony Orchestra. And we have been friends for so many years. He's American, but he is based in the United Kingdom, which is how we know each other. And we've never had the opportunity to work together until being in Seattle. I mean, he's a wonderful conductor anyway, but it's just so wonderful having that open and trusting working relationship where you can say when things aren't quite working. And, you know, it can be a difficult thing to say, especially if you don't know someone that well. And it's just great, and we're going to be working on other projects in the future, and that's really cool. But then, you know, more often than not, you might not get the opportunity to work together over and over again. And so it's just about somehow striking up a rapport even when you don't have that much time. And so there's always, well, I always ask for the opportunity to meet with the conductor before we actually rehearse together, so go through the score together. And, you know, more often than not, because they've studied it, they've looked at it, they know exactly what's happening. And then it's just about adding information that they might not have got by looking on the page. And so just being, yeah, open and honest. And I'm just thinking about it, I've just worked with so many great conductors, and it's like George Benjamin is incredible, because he's an incredible composer as well. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you're working with a composer conductor, that's really cool, because they know the anxieties that you're having and the nerves and the just, you know, the whole thing. And he was just incredible, because he, you know, really cares about the, you know, the notes and how you feel as a composer, because, you know, he's been there. And, you know, so that's really cool. And then, you know, Jonathan's great because we're friends. And then Edward Gardner, he's a great, yeah, just amazing. Mm. Yeah. And it's just, it's, you know, it's a privilege to have someone take that much care over your music. And so yeah, it is an important relationship. Yeah.
Great. All right. So can you tell me, what skills do you need to be a composer?
I suppose it depends what type of composer you want to be, because there are so many different types of composers. Mm-hmm. So, for example, writing to screen, as in, so for films and TV, that's something that I, you know, something I'd love to do, but I, you know, I've never done. And I have friends who do that specifically, and they're just so great at that. And it's about working closely with the director more often than not, and the director having the say and knowing what it is that they want for their piece for screen. And sometimes I think, whilst I'd love to do that, I'd find that so difficult, because I can just do what I want. It's like, in this part, I want it to sound like this, but I'm not sure how easy I would find it working to that sort of brief. And there are composers who work a lot with electronics. And so, you know, so it can vary just depending on what it is that you want to do. But I think primarily you have to have a good ear, and you have to know what works well for whatever medium or whatever parameters that you're working in. And I don't really want to say you have to be, I don't even want to say that you have to be able to read or write music, because, you know, in this day and age, there are so many incredible composers who might not necessarily have those skills, but are creating new industries that might not necessarily need the same detail or the same skills that I have, whereas, you know, they're making incredible careers doing different things that I wouldn't necessarily be able to do. Personally, I'm so grateful that I had the opportunity to learn music as in the notation from an early age. So, you know, as you say, it's a language, and being able to read music on the page and understand it and hear it, that's such an incredible skill to have, and I'm so, so grateful for that. But I wouldn't want to say that a skill that one needs to be a composer, because, you know, technology and new ways of working, that is really, really exciting.
It's not really a skill, but one thing that struck me since we've been talking is that you have a real confidence in your ability to take a project on. And I wonder if confidence helps work through that creative process and developing one skill. Because like you said, you just decided to do this one-man opera yourself. You took it all on and you know, pushing yourself through. And you must have had some sense of confidence, I can do this, and what I'm creating, there's a space for it.
I think it's important to have confidence in your abilities. I mean, we all get imposter syndrome, and whilst we shouldn't, we probably all compare ourselves to other people and to our contemporaries and our peers. And also what's really annoying is that other people compare you to your contemporaries and peers as well. And that's something that I've always tried to avoid, because there's just no good that can come from that. I don't know, I just, you know, I remember a few years ago that, because I have very close friends who are very successful composers, and there would be other people who would say, oh, you know, don't worry, Hannah, you'll get there one day. And I was like, you know, how is that helping? I hadn't even considered, you know, I don't want to compare myself. And what does even getting there one day mean? Exactly. Because their there is completely different to my there. And we have to get out of the temptation to just you know, sort of lump everyone together and to be some sort of competitive, I don't know, competitive sport or whatever. The beauty of what we're doing is that we're all individual, and the beauty in it is that we're trying to develop unique artistry. And I think I gained more confidence once I realised what it is that I want to do very specifically as an artist, which is like, is probably not the same as anyone else, and that's great. And I can have confidence from the fact that the goals that I want to achieve are completely different to, you know, the composer next to me. And also to have confidence in the fact that some people might not like my music, and that's absolutely fine. Some people love it, and that's great too. Cool. And just being true to whatever it is that you want to achieve. And I know that, I suppose I have confidence in knowing that I worked hard to get into, you know, some of the best places that one can go to train to do what it is that I'm doing. And so even if there is someone who is trying to compare me to anyone else, or, you know, will try and put that on my back or on my shoulders, I know that, well, you know, I trained at, you know, the really top places with under incredible people. And, you know, through my doctoral fellowship, I'm still having the opportunity to grow and learn and to broaden, and that I can, you know, just know that I'm meant to be where I am, and that I'm worthy of being at whatever this table is that people are calling, you know, the contemporary classical arena. Yeah, but I think, you know, as I'm talking, I think confidence comes from knowing what it is that you want to do, and not trying to be anyone else, and not trying to sound like anyone else. Because, you know, really, writing good music is kind of the easy part, actually, because there are hundreds, if not thousands, of really good composers. But the really difficult thing is finding out what it is that you want to say and how you want it to sound through your music. And once you've nailed that, then I think you have all the confidence.
I definitely see that. And I think there's been a few interviews throughout the series where women have talked about that whole notion of not having a comparison and creating your own vision of what success is, and not being distracted by that. And I feel like I've had that happen in the past. So I love it when I hear other people say that, and I'm like, yes, that's exactly it. Can I ask you what's been one of the biggest challenges in your career?
I don't know. I mean, the whole thing's a pretty challenge, isn't it? It's a pretty big challenge.
Yeah.
Is that, sorry, that's what I do, is kind of dodging your question. It's just the whole thing's very challenging, isn't it? And I don't think that will ever change. So I can't really think of any one specific thing, because, you know, it was challenging starting relatively late in composition. So I was teaching, had a great student at Junior Academy. You know, I think I was working with him when he was 15 or 16, and now he's got a scholarship at Oxford and he's doing incredible things. I was like, oh my goodness, like, he's had, you know, one-to-one composition lessons since the age of 15. Like, oh my goodness, that's incredible. I can't wait to see, you know, where he gets in the future. So it was a challenge having to catch up at, in the grand scheme of things, relatively late age, at the age of 20, 21. And then it's, what I felt at the time, it was a challenge of sort of asserting myself, you know, sort of in the conservatoire system, and not outwardly, but sort of presenting myself as deserving of being there. So that's then a challenge. In those environments, that's where the comparison happens, and you're all trying to get your first opportunity. So then that's challenging. And then you graduate, and then everyone graduates with a distinction or a first, or, you know, whatever. And I always remember Dominic Madani saying that when I did a course with him, and he was just like, well, you all probably have distinctions or firsts, which you do, because, again, you're at great institutions. It's what you want to do. You work hard, you graduate at a high level, but then it's about actually getting writing opportunities. So it's just lots of different challenges as you go along, and then you build the foundations. Now I feel as though I've got to a stage where I know exactly what I want to do. And there are some commissions that I might be asked to do, but I don't want to do that. And have, you know, the challenge of saying no to those things is actually really challenging, because, you know, what's the point? And you want to shape your career in a certain direction. And then I have friends who are in their 50s and 60s, and like, we're in our 50s and 60s. We're not even asked to write music anymore. It's really difficult because we're not necessarily seen as the new young composers coming up. And so there are just so many challenges at every different stage of a career. But I think maybe one thing I would say is about maybe trying to foreshadow what those challenges are, and to try and to stop those challenges from coming about. And I think as I'm just talking now, I've realised that I probably did try and do that in anticipation of what the challenge coming next might be. Mm. And so, yeah, it's difficult yeah. game. Good luck, everyone.
So what do you love about being a composer?
I like that I enjoy what I do, even though there aren't that many enjoyable parts of the process, which sounds really depressing, but as in there are just so many difficult parts, as in it's really difficult starting, and then it's okay in the middle part's okay, like when you're in the flow's great. And then it's a really difficult ending, and then there's a deadline, and then you think you're finished, and then you're never finished. It just seems never ending. Yeah, there's definitely nothing else that I'd want to be doing. The process itself is very difficult, mm-hmm. but I think I enjoy being a role model for other people. You know, there isn't the specific nitty-gritty of actually writing, but I love all of those extra, you know, parts that can come from that. And I suppose I like that. I mean, it's a good sign that, you know, I could write all day and, you know, could quite happily sit and write all day, mm-hmm. as in that's what I would love to be doing. But obviously, you know, there's, you know, life that, you know, things that you have to do. But I've never really thought about that. It's difficult. I don't know. Wow. Did you want a succinct answer?
No, I love that you asked something. Because I guess I have a really romantic, I've noticed this through this interview, of what you do, because like it's so magical to me, because it's not something I have, you know, access yeah. to in terms of the language and how it fits together. But you know, I always get a sense of like when you see something live, whether it's an opera or even a play, you know, the audience reactions in the moment, and it's responding to what you've created and put out there. Like that notion to me would be something I imagined anyone who writes be something they love. But that's, again, my complete projection.
Mm. That's really interesting. My personality is to keep it quite real. And so I do actually say that a lot. I say, obviously, tongue in cheek, but, you know, and rightly so, music is so many people's hobby that people might think that you're doing your hobby, and not to, and I don't mean
I'm just going to say understate. I am definitely not saying that.
Oh no, not at all. No, yeah, I know. But as in, there's a perception, and I think it's specific to music, where I think, you know, my friends who aren't in music, they just think, oh, I just play the piano all day and I'm having a great time, and it's just, you know, and it's not that. It's actually real graft and real hard work, and it's a lot of maths as well, actually. It's a lot of counting and dividing and multiplying and then subdividing some more. Lots of numbers involved and harmony, and it's really tiring. And then there's imposter syndrome, and then it's, you know, wanting to take the risk to be, you know, creative in new ways, but then, you know, having the weight of knowing that, you know, massive orchestra spent so much money on you. And then it's like, you know, what if I take a risk and it goes in the wrong way? And also just practical things of writing classical music takes so long, and you know, your friends are like, do you want to go to the beach, it's really hot today, and they don't understand why you need to be at your desk for 9 hours. And so it's just juggling all of these things.
But that's the creative process. So I'm not romanticising that. I'm just sticking up for myself here.
Oh, no, not at all. No, I'm not.
I totally get that.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, like in my own filmmaking, I've had moments where I've spent months on residencies shooting, and I shoot on celluloid, so it's not cheap. And then on opening of an exhibition, you know, being around the corner bawling my eyes out because it's shit. And, you know, and all that, and you're exhausted from getting all together and whatever.
Yeah.
So, but it's, I guess, for me, music is such a powerful, emotive art.
Yeah.
And so I guess that romance comes in that, with in my mind, that the way people react to music.
That is amazing, but I don't think, and I think you're right about that, absolutely. I can't speak for any other composer, but I can't imagine that many composers, especially at a premiere, at the first thing, that, or the first time a piece is being performed, that a composer is thinking that. And it's such a shame. And I always say to my friends, it's great that you're here, you're having a great time, and you've got the champagne, and there's a reception, and it's all great. And I'm like, oh my goodness, everyone's going to hate it. Yep. And it's just, sorry, I'm putting a real downer on this. But it was great being in Seattle, I have to say, last month, because they were playing a piece that had already been written and knew that people liked it, and it was great success at the premiere, so I knew that'd be great. And they played it three times and the audience loved it, and I was like, oh yeah, this is so much better when it's not
fresh.
Yes. And I was just like, great, I'm having a great time. But actually, it's really difficult for composers to get repeat performances of large works for orchestra, and so that, I think that's what I hadn't really experienced that often. And so gosh, maybe this feels a bit like therapy. You're making me realise that actually, once things are performed, you know, not for the first time, it's actually really enjoyable, and you know it's going to work, and you can just sit back and be like, yeah, this is
and feel it.
And actually really feel it.
Yeah.
We don't really get a chance to really, really feel it. And that is a shame. That is a shame for us. Yeah.
So there's lots to love, I can see.
What is there to love? Yeah. Did I put anything in there?
You did.
Did I? Okay.
Then when it gets played for the second time.
Oh, yeah, that's right. When it gets played for the second time, it's really cool. Yeah.
Cool. So what's one piece of advice you'd give someone considering a career in composing?
I would advise them to have a really good mentor that isn't necessarily about actually writing music or being a composer, but someone who can just be really open and honest about the challenges, as well as the high points, which there are, I promise. And I was just always really grateful for the honesty of my teacher from Royal College of Music in particular. You know, he's the person, is Kenneth Hesketh, he's the person I will, you know, text, and I'm like, oh my goodness, I'm like, what do I do about this? And he'll just be really direct, really honest, and just really keep it real. And he always had a really great insight into, I think, because he's married to a composer, to Arlene Sierra, and, you know, as I'm talking, maybe I just realised this, he always had a really good insight into being a woman composer as well, and he would always highlight specific challenges that I might come up against, and so I always really appreciated that. So you just have to find a really good mentor who's done it already and not be afraid about going to them. So that's one piece of advice. Another piece of advice I would give is to have a very, very clear idea about what you want to achieve, and to have sort of a vision map. A friend of mine, she's an incredible soprano, Nadine Benjamin, and one day I thought we were just having a coffee, but she's a high performance mentor as well. I thought we were just having a coffee, and then she made me do my vision map, and I was like, what is that? And it's just literally visioning what you want to achieve from your career, whether you're at the beginning, well, at any point in your career, and just very specifically pinpointing what it is that you want to do. And, you know, after she made me do that first vision map, I looked back and I had achieved so many different things because I was just committing to them. And that was before I'd done The Knife of Dawn. And actually, it's kind of amazing. So I want to write an opera. I want to have works done in America. And, you know, now, like a few years later, I'm actually living in America, and which I had no idea would be happening, and working with all these incredible ensembles. And she was just literally just really commit all the things that you want to do, all the people you want to work with, and then you'll be committed to finding ways to make it happen. So those are the two things I would suggest.
And do you update your vision?
Oh, yeah, no, definitely. Okay. So I update it regularly. Mm-hmm. So I do it every year.
Okay.
Yeah, see. But I keep them all because it's so a good reminder.
And the path that you
yeah, because things might not happen in a year, you know, but it's good to keep that refreshed.
Yeah. So how do you fuel your own creativity? What do you do? Where do you go?
For me, it's through reading. I read a lot. I need to spend a lot of time by myself. I'm really open and honest about that now. I've got to an age where I'm like, I need to be by myself and I need to think and I need to read and I need to... Because I'm an introvert, like as in, you know, after this is great, but I will not want to speak to anyone for 12 hours.
I'm glad it wasn't 3 days.
Because, you know, it's great doing these things, but I just, you know, it's my way of... Yeah, my way of recharging and refueling is, you know, being by myself, reading. You know, I'm just inspired by other people's thoughts and experiences of the world. And, you know, it's really interesting when you find that someone thinks and feels the same way as you. So I've been reading Baldwin recently and, you know, his writings in the, you know, 50s and 60s, you know, could be completely relevant today. And oh my goodness, it's almost as though, you know, on the one hand, you could think, oh gosh, you're just so ahead of your time that you're thinking things before they happened. But then on the other hand, you're like, oh my goodness, things haven't changed at all. Mm. Or, you know, and just like different... You know, different perspectives, but it's even more interesting when you're reading the points of views of people who you don't agree with or resonate with in any way, and that's equally as powerful. And so for me, I find that incredibly fulfilling. And yeah, just it's other people's thoughts and experiences. And so yeah, so once I've recharged and refueled, I then do actually like to speak to people and, you know, mull that over. And so human connection and experiences, that's what really matters to me. Mm. Yeah.
We're coming to the end of the interview and I, you know, I'm beaming because I'm so happy to have finally got to catch up with you and learn a bit more about you and that you've shattered my romantic notion of what it is to be a composer.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I feel as though...
I don't know. It's actually, I totally understand the creative process. And actually, that I think it's that notion of when you, like I said, I don't really have access to it, but actually it's just really similar to all the other creative processes. Yeah. Maybe I'll still hold a little bit of it. I'm struggling to let it go. But yeah. Or
maybe talk to someone else and then they'll be like, oh, yeah. Yeah.
Cool. Before you go, something I ask everyone, is there a career job in the creative industries that you know little about and like to know more about and potentially get someone on the podcast in that role so I could explore that a bit more, maybe for the next series? And also a woman within the creative industries that you would nominate that I get on Grade 11%.
How cool would it be to have Phoebe Waller-Bridge on? I think that would be really cool. She's making really... big waves. I think she's really good. I think she's just genuinely really funny as well. Yeah. I actually went to school with her. She was in the year below me. Yeah. And so I have vague recollections of us being, you know, sort of like 12, 13, 14. But I think her voice is unique and just funny. And she's changing... Yeah, she's just changing things. Mm-hmm. And I think she's really cool.
So
that would be good. That would be a catch.
Yeah.
But there are just, you know, there's just so many people. I met an incredible artist, Phoebe Boswell, the other day. And as in literally, I met her 2 weeks ago at Tate Britain at a talk, the exhibition of Frank Bowling, but he was Guyanese born British artist, and he's this incredible retrospective on at Tate Britain. And she had written a letter to him that she was reading to us just about being an artist of colour and just all of the, you know, even though, you know, there's 50 years difference age between them, but how she's inspired by him, and oh, it was just so incredible. And, you know, then I was looking at her work is just, which is mostly figurative, and it's just so evocative, and it's challenging so many things, and so no, it's too difficult to just say one person. Okay. I'm sorry, I could
Phoebe Boswell sounds amazing.
Both Phoebe.
I know. I was expecting a third one. We've got another Phoebe up your sleeve.
I know. I don't. But I think what's really exciting is that space is being created for women to say what it is that they need and want to say, and how interesting are things getting because of that. Mm. And it's just mixing things up, and it's not about pushing anyone else out. It's just about creating space for women, and that is really cool, and that is really exciting, and that's something to be celebrated.
I think that is the perfect ending for series one.
Oh, good. Because I didn't answer your other question, so that's good. We'll end there.
Oh, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been such a pleasure.
Before we cut to the jingle, I want to let you know that this episode now concludes series one of Greater Than 11%. It has been a wild ride and heaps of fun. What an honour and pleasure to have interviewed 52 incredible women who have generously shared their creative journeys and given a heap of advice in relation to their specific roles. I want to say thank you to everyone who has subscribed and listened, sent messages of encouragement, and have rated and reviewed the podcast. It always gives us such a warm glow to know people are listening and enjoying it. A special thank you to Stella and also Martin, who are a constant source of positive feedback. We never tire of it. A huge thank you to Patrick Murray, who produces the podcast each week, who is a wonderful human being, and who has graciously put up with me mentioning at every opportunity his fondness for Love Island. We will be back with Series 2 in a few short months with some exciting changes and additions to the format, so follow us on Instagram to keep up with the news. But before then, there is a bonus episode next week where the microphone has been flipped and it is me answering the questions. We're super excited about the next series and look forward to being back on the air towards the end of the year.